me that I need to focus right here, right now, or there won't be a future for humans or Ruhar. Listen, Chaika, she whispered. Talk with Dahl or Jaitz. See if they found any details about the bioweapon the lizards brought to Earth. I've been so worried about this new weapon I forgot about the earlier threat. Maybe they recovered enough data for Ruhar medical scanners, she nodded toward a hard-cased medical pack attached to the cabin wall, to detect whether we have been exposed or not.
The tests were inconclusive, the Ruhar cadet announced with a frightened expression.
What are the results? Perkins demanded.
You have to understand I'm not a doctor. I am only in my second year at the academy, the cadet protested. This device, this scanner, is also not programmed for human physiology, and I might have adjusted it incorrectly. It could be wrong, or it...
What are the results? Perkins asked in a softer tone. I understand you are doing your best under difficult circumstances. Still, I need information on which to make decisions. Please tell me what the device indicates.
She thought that was easier than asking a young Ruhar, barely into medical studies, to render her own opinion.
The scanner has detected antibodies in the blood of all six of you. It is very likely that you have all been exposed to the bioweapon that was developed for use against humans on your homeworld, on Earth.
Oh, shit, Irene groaned.
Sergeant Chaika's right, Colonel. We need to go ASAP while we can still fly. And fight.
Hold on, Strebich.
Perkins held up a hand to halt the frenzied conversation that had sprung up around her.
I don't remember a lot from the biology course I took in college, but I do know that on Earth we use two types of viruses as vaccines. A live virus that has been weakened,
how that worked she had no idea,
and a dead virus, a virus that has been killed. A dead virus can't harm you, but it does provoke your immune system to create antibodies somehow, so if you were ever infected with the real virus, your immune system recognizes the threat and already knows how to kill it.
Did I get that right?
Correct,
the Ruhar cadet agreed, slightly embarrassed for the primitive humans. The crude process of using actual viruses to create vaccines was something she learned about in her medical history class. That technique had not been used by the Ruhar for thousands of years, yet humans still relied on low-tech ancient technology.
Tell me this. Is it possible the pathogen we've been exposed to is dead? It must have been years since the Kristang dispersed it in the air here. All that time it has been exposed to air, rainwater, heat, cold, ultraviolet radiation from the star, right? Maybe our immune systems were exposed to dead remnants of the bioweapon.
That is possible, yes, the cadet said slowly, then lifted her head as she warmed to the idea.
I was only given a brief overview of human physiology, but I believe your immunity cells react to proteins on the outer coating of a virus phage. Does that make sense?
Perkins looked to her team for help, but none of them had any idea. Derek tilted his head and frowned.
That sounds about right. I saw something like that on the Discovery Channel.
He grinned sheepishly.
Good.
Yeah, Perkins agreed. If that is true, then it is possible.
The cadet smiled.
No, it is likely that your antibodies are a reaction to exposure to the dead pathogen. Colonel Perkins, I very much doubt that a relatively crude bioweapon like the one described in the files we found could survive exposure to the elements on this planet for such a long time.
Good. Perkins breathed a sigh of relief.
I do not like the idea of dying of a horrible disease on this rock. We still have to proceed as if we are infected because we can't take the chance. The incubation period of that original bioweapon has a couple weeks, right?
Yes, according to the data recovered. The cadet acknowledged with a pained stare down at her display.
Colonel, please consider that even if you are infected, you might have been exposed to an early, less effective form of the pathogen, or the pathogen may be degraded by exposure here, in which case there may be a longer incubation period.
Yes, or the data we recovered might not have contained details of the final, more effective pathogen. I can't take the risk we could all get very sick soon before we can attack that base and get the research data we need.
Thank you, Cadet.
Perkins cut off further discussion. Her throat had been feeling sore for the past 3 days, and it felt worse that morning. She remembered her throat being sore the last time she was on Camp Alpha.
Was it just the irritating, burnt-tasting dust that covered everything? Or was she infected and on the verge of a full-blown fatal disease? Perkins put Arlon Dahl and a team of Ruhar cadets on the task of hacking into the research files of the Kristang base, hoping they could extract data detailing the pathogen's chemical signatures, life cycle, test results, and possible antigens. The next morning, she walked to the dropship that was being used for the hacking effort, just as Nert walked down the open side ramp. The Ruhar cadet waved to her, then bent backwards and forwards with a grimace.
"Are you well, cadet?" Perkins asked.
"Yes, Colonel Perkins. My back is sore from sitting at the console for too long."
"The team is working very hard," he assured her.
"We worked all night."
"Any results?"
"No. Their security around the lab computer is very strong. Arlon Dahl says it is airtight."
"We can't access the data remotely?"
Nert looked distractedly at the tablet in one hand.
"We would have better luck playing pick-up sticks with our butt cheeks."
Despite the seriousness of the situation, she had to smile.
"Nert, is that another colorful expression you learned from the 3rd Infantry?"
"No."
He turned toward her, his skin under the light fur turning a darker shade of pink.
"I heard that from Shauna, that is, Sergeant Jarrett. Is it a bad thing to say?"
"No. It is only discouraging to hear."
"The team is continuing to work on the problem,"
Nert forced a smile.
"But they're not optimistic, are they?"
"No, Colonel, they are not. I must be truthful. There has been no progress for the past 7 hours. The remaining methods we could use to access the data remotely pose a serious risk of our cyber attack being detected. I am sorry."
"Don't be sorry, cadet. You and the team have endured harsh conditions and performed far beyond expectations. It looks like..."
She looked off to the horizon, far beyond which lay the Kristang base.
"We'll have to do this the hard way."
"There is no way to extract that data remotely?" Perkins requested confirmation of the gloomy news Nert had brought to her.
"I am sorry. No. Perhaps if we had a team of experts from our data security division, but..."
Ernt waved a claw to encompass the tired group around him.
"They are Ruhar cadets, and I am not a computer expert."
"You did your best. That's all I can ask. Damn it. If we go in and the lizards spot us before we can get to the data core, they could erase the memory and we'd lose everything, all their records."
She tugged the hair on the back of her head in frustration.
"The research computer may be programmed to erase itself in the event of an attack on the base."
She turned her attention to the two Verdgris.
"What do we know about this research base?"
"Not enough," Tutula pointed to her display. "We have the original schematics of the compound, back when the Kristang built it to study the star here and its effects on the planet. They were hoping to understand how the Elder Weapon created a focused solar flare that cooked this world."
She grinned and bounced her eyeballs up and down in the Verdgris equivalent of an eye roll.
"They had no chance of understanding technology on that level. The base has been expanded and modified over the years, especially the research facilities, and we do not have access to those records other than very basic information."
"Very well." Perkins unfolded a chair and sat down. "Show me what we do know."
"What's the plan, ma'am?" Shauna asked, looking up from her tablet.
All eyes turned to the human commander, with the two Verdgris in particular waiting intently to hear what the primitive being would say. Perkins took a breath, steadying herself.
"I say we go in hot, kill everyone, take the data, and bug out quick."
She looked to Irene, then Derek, then the two Verdgris pilots.
"If it moves and it's not us, kill it. I don't care about collateral damage to the base buildings as long as you don't hit the main research complex."
"What about your keeper people?"
Tutula asked, pronouncing keeper slowly.
"We believe there are still a group of humans at the base."
"Don't fire on them deliberately."
Perkins's hard expression softened slightly.
"But don't take any risk either. If there's a..."
She almost said lizard.
"If there's an enemy shooting at us and he's surrounded by keepers, take them all out."
"You are willing to sacrifice your own people to accomplish the mission?"
Tutula's eyes narrowed as she waited for Perkins's answer. As far as I'm concerned, those keepers have pretty much fucked themselves. Perkins spat on the dusty ground. I'm not risking a single one of our lives for them. You have a problem with that? She stared Tutula straight in the eye.
No, Colonel Perkins.
Tutula's lips twitched in what was intended as a smile.
Your mission focus is admirable. My people are not cruel like the Krestang you have encountered in the past, but we are also not soft. We do not believe in half measures.
A shadow fell across her expression, and she added in a low voice,
With our small numbers against those of the warrior caste who have stolen and perverted our culture, we cannot afford to be sentimental.
Perkins nodded. There are less than 24 keepers at that base, if we can believe the outdated info we retrieved. Over 100,000 humans are on Paradise, and millions of Ruhar. We are not putting all those lives at risk just to possibly rescue a small number of keepers. When they removed the UNEF insignia from their uniforms, they should have gotten a big chicken dinner. Perkins forgot the aliens would not understand the slang for bad conduct discharge. I don't hate the keepers. Most of them are too stupid to know what they're doing. But they got themselves into this mess, and now their mess is threatening all the lives on Paradise and maybe beyond. Ma'am, Shauna's face had a strained, uncomfortable expression.
What will we do if we take out the enemy and there are keepers still alive?
We can't take them with us, Perkins noted. We have to assume they're all infected and we have to minimize our exposure. That means our suits stay buttoned up the whole time, and we follow full decontamination procedures on the egress. We can't bring infected keepers with us. She continued to use the term keepers, because if she called them humans or people, it would be more difficult to ignore their situation. If we accomplish the mission and some keepers survive, their best bet is to remain in place. She almost used derogatory slang in front of the Verdgris. The Krestang must have food for the keepers there. We certainly don't have enough food with us to feed that number of people. They can remain at the base. Though Shauna still looked uncomfortable, her arms across her chest and shoulders slumped forward, curled into herself. She nodded briefly.
We have to tell them about the bioweapon program. They deserve to know the truth.
Dave snorted.
Come on, Shauna. Those sleepers have had the truth staring them in the face for years, and they don't see it because they don't want to see it. What makes you think that us telling them the Krestang have been using them as lab rats will change their mind?
Hey, chill, Ski, Jesse replied in defense of his girlfriend, putting an arm around Shauna's shoulders to show he understood her feelings on the subject. Like the Colonel said, some of them are just too dumb to know what they're doing, or they're gullible and followed the wrong people. Look at Eric Koblenz. Yeah, the guy was a grade-A asshole, but I don't think he would do anything to kill people on Paradise. His own people.
Okay, Pone, yeah. Eric was too dumb to know what he's doing, Dave agreed.
We should tell them, Irene added. If they don't believe us now, they will when they all start dying in a couple months.
Hell.
Jesse kicked the dusty ground with the toe of a boot.
What a freaking mess. How did we get such bad karma?
Bad? Perkins pretended to be surprised.
Coulter, this is good karma in disguise. If our star carrier hadn't gotten blown up, we would never have known about the threat to Paradise, and we would not now have this marvelous opportunity to shine.
Jesse tilted his head at their commanding officer.
You do know what opportunity means in the military, right, ma'am?
I do, Coulter, and my ass will be on the line right beside you.
Tutula clapped her hands, startling the humans.
I see an opportunity for direct action against the warrior caste who have oppressed my people for millennia. When do we start, Colonel Perkins?
Now. Prep a dropship. The dropship, with Tutula and Derek flying the outbound leg and Irene acting as relief pilot, followed a medium, then low-altitude stealth flight profile until it was within 600 kilometers of the base, where the ship's sensors picked up the faintest traces of backscatter from the network of active sensors surrounding the base. At that point, with risk of detection approaching an unacceptable 3%, Derek gently turned 180 degrees, reduced speed, and gradually lost altitude while the others prepped the package. A minute later,
A door opened under the dropship's tail, and a stream of stealthy foam-covered balls fell out, tumbling smoothly as they fell away. The dropship gradually increased power and climbed, while the crew anxiously monitored extremely faint data feeds from the cluster of more than 3 dozen sensor drones they had ejected. When each drone fell to 4,000 feet above the ground, an invisible nanofiber parachute deployed, spreading wide and momentarily bringing its payload almost to a halt in midair. The foam coating dissolved, and the drone unfolded itself, sprouting wings that swept back to allow the hummingbird-sized drone to build airspeed. Each drone checked in with its fellows by line-of-sight laser link, and only one drone out of the 38 was found to be operating at less than the optimal level. As that drone was not needed, it self-destructed with the consent of its flock, sending particles no larger than a fingernail to rain softly down and bury into the dusty ground. Flying slowly to conserve fuel and avoiding tripping enemy motion sensors by artificially disturbing the air, the flock of drones approached the base, encircling it. Several times a drone had to go into hover mode as it was swept by an active sensor pulse. The risk was that the Kristang might have set their air cover sensors on an ultra-sensitive mode, for the planet had no flying animal life, and therefore, anything moving in a way not detected by the prevailing winds had to be a threat. One drone, pinned in place by an active sensor pulse that came back to sweep over it 3 times, self-destructed to avoid detection, so no alarm was raised at the base. None of the drones risked overflying the site, but as the base was in a mountain valley, no overflight was needed. One by one, the drones set down just inside the lines of ridges and foothills, selecting locations where they had line of sight to the base below on the valley floor. Each drone focused its own passive sensors on a different area of the base, switching focus in a pre-programmed, coordinated fashion to provide a 3-dimensional map of the target.
Ah, damn it!
Dave threw up his hands as he saw the recently assembled composite image of the Kristang research base. His frustration was not because of the base's defenses, for those appeared to be minimal. There were only 2 anti-aircraft Maser batteries, and the Mavericks could deal with those before the assault. The single dropship assigned to the base was also not a problem. It was out of its hardened underground bunker with one of the engines laying exposed on the ground in pieces. As Dave watched, 2 Kristang were having an animated argument about the disassembled engine, shouting something at each other. The sensors were too far away to pick up the lizard's words, and Dave didn't give a rat's ass what 2 murderous assholes were saying anyway. What he did care about was on the other side of the base in a separate compound surrounded by a double fence. What he saw there made him angry. A group of a half dozen humans standing around in the morning sunlight. Several others walked between buildings in the compound, and from the size of the buildings, Dave guessed there might be as many as 50 humans housed there. He zoomed in the image to the point where, despite the super high-tech image stabilization and enhancement gear of the sensors, he still had to blink to understand what the slightly fuzzy view was showing him. Then he understood, for he had seen that same image many times before in his military career. The rectangular areas of flattened dirt were where tents had been set up, tents or some other type of temporary shelter. People had walked over the flattened ground after the tents had been removed, but the heavy tracks leading to where the tents had been, he knew they had been occupied at some point. Probably the compound recently had held many more humans, perhaps double or triple the number that could be housed in the permanent buildings. Interesting, he muttered. Then,
Colonel, ma'am, we got a problem.
What is it, Chaika?
Keepers,
he nearly spat with disgust. From the enhanced image, he could see the people standing around in the sunlight were wearing military uniforms, so they had to be keepers. There are at least a dozen of those shitheads from what I've seen. Could be more still in those buildings.
That's the control group, then.
Perkins looked at Ernt Dahl. Control group? She looked at the Giraptha, who was shifting his rear pair of legs nervously. Perkins explained. Arlon Dahl found information that one group of keepers here was used as a control group. They were not infected, while other groups were infected with different versions of the pathogen. If a test group became sick unexpectedly but the control group also got sick, the Kristang would know the cause was some environmental factor and not the experimental pathogen. Until now, we did not know whether any of the control group was still alive, because the records Dahl could access stopped updating when the last group of researchers left this planet. We do know all the Ruhar they brought here are dead. They used the Ruhar control group for the final test.
Well, I wonder why that group of keepers is still alive.
Jesse rubbed the back of his neck.
I mean, why bother? You can see from that double layer fence the lizards here think those keepers are a security risk.
Insurance? Shauna guessed. In case something goes wrong with the op on Paradise, or in case they decide to use the pathogen on another Ruhar planet, maybe. Dave tapped the display again.
Ma'am, I just thought of something.
That control group. They've been here a long time, right?
Likely they came here soon after they left Paradise. Why?
If we've been exposed to the original bioweapon by breathing the air here, the one the lizards plan to use on Earth, then those keepers must have been exposed also.
Damn. Jesse slapped Dave on the back.
You're right, man. They're still alive, so we must have been exposed only to a dead virus. We're good.
Not necessarily, Perkins stated with a frown, and Dave nodded agreement.
The keepers may have been given a vaccine against the original bioweapon.
Yeah.
And in that case, Dave tapped the display. The vaccine must be in that base somewhere. Would a vaccine do us any good now that we've already been exposed?
I don't know, Perkins admitted.
Colonel Perkins,
Ernt Dahl crossed his forearms.
I am not an expert on biological weapons, but I doubt the Kristang would have vaccinated or treated the humans here against another pathogen. Because humans on Paradise have not been exposed to the original pathogen, giving the control group here a vaccine or post-infection treatment would alter their immune response from the baseline and reduce their usefulness as a true control group.
Oh. Yeah, that makes sense.
Perkins's mouth was a flat line across her face. Unless the Kristang didn't have a choice about it, since they had contaminated this whole planet already.
Chaika, good thinking. We'll look for a treatment or something when we get inside that base.
Shit. That original bioweapon is another damn good reason why we need to take that base soon.
Not just to protect ourselves, Dave said, knowing what she was thinking.
No. If there is a vaccine or treatment in there somewhere, we need it. If we ever get to Earth and the lizards there haven't already used the bioweapon against our people, we need a countermeasure.
Can we do it?
Bottom line. Perkins stood with her arms crossed after reviewing the data gathered by the sensors.
Yes.
Tatula's confidence was absolute.
Their air defenses are minimal.
She looked to Ernt Dahl for confirmation. The beetle raised its antenna in a sort of shrug.
I am not an expert on anti-aircraft systems. I am not familiar with the subject at all. My training was for fleet service, he admitted.
Their air defenses are weak and degraded.
Tutula enhanced the display image, highlighting two areas.
These are defensive maser turrets. I suspect one of them is offline and has been that way for a long time.
How do you know that? Perkins asked, leaning forward to get a better view.
These turrets require regular maintenance and test firing after components are replaced. The turret to the south has vehicle tracks leading from the base and footprints around the site. Vehicle tracks at the north site have been obscured by blowing sand and there are no footprints. Also, this hatch.
She zoomed in the view so powerfully that the image became fuzzy and shook slightly.
It is open. It should be closed. I think someone tried to fix a mechanical failure in that turret and gave up. With the warrior caste,
she avoided using the word Kristang,
scheduled to abandon this planet, they would not expend much effort to maintain facilities here.
Okay, I see that.
That is a hell of a risk to take with our aircraft space, based on a lack of footprints and one open hatch.
That is not all, Colonel Perkins. As I said, the masers would be test-fired after components have been replaced. You can see here on the hills to the south scorch marks where maser beams struck. Those marks are still dark, indicating that turret was fired recently, and the maser fire must have come from the southern turret because they would not have risked firing over the base. There are no scorch marks on hills to the north. We can't absolutely verify condition of the northern turret because that data is behind their secure firewall.
Dahl's antenna waved in agreement with that statement.
So we need to trust our own eyes.
All right, Strebich, Bonsu, do you agree?
Yes, ma'am.
Irene nodded. The three of us covered this last night. It's doable.
Those Mazer turrets are armored, Perkins observed skeptically.
Your dropships aren't.
The turrets are armored, plus they have an energy shield, Irene added with a frown.
And you're right. Our ships are vulnerable. But we have an ace in the hole. Part of the weapons load we brought down from the toaster are anti-AA missiles, kind of like the HARM system our Navy and Air Forces use.
Those seed systems home in on active sensors, right? Perkins noted. Not on the anti-air weapon itself. The Kristang must use a distributed sensor network.
They do. Irene groaned inwardly, wanting to avoid a long session of educating their commander about the finer points of suppression of enemy air defenses.
These Ruhar missiles are smart. They know Kristang anti-air masers use a look-look-shoot pattern. Two low-powered beam bursts to track and confirm the target lock, followed by the kill shot. Each of the Ruhar HARMs deploys 28 submunitions that look for Mazer backscatter. Once they pinpoint the Mazer's location, they kill it. Some of the submunitions fire their own Mazer countermeasures to scramble the enemy's targeting data, while the others home in and kill the turret.
Ma'am, in this case we have an advantage. We already know exactly where that turret is. We plan to launch our anti-AA missiles before we come over the ridgeline. We saturate their defenses, knock them out before exposing ourselves.
The base doesn't have any missile batteries?
No. There is a site here to the west where they plan to install missiles. You can see where they bulldozed the site and installed part of this concrete pad here.
On the display, Irene pointed to a broken concrete tile half covered with drifting sand.
They stopped work on it. We know there are not any underground sensor feeds to that area.
What about manpads? Dave asked, peering over Perkins's shoulder.
Manpad? Dahl asked, confused.
He tapped his right ear.
My translator did not understand that reference.
Man-portable air defense, Dave explained, miming that he held a missile tube on one shoulder.
A shoulder-launched anti-aircraft missile, you know?
Ah, yes. The Giraptha's antennas bounced up and down.
Our military has such devices, though I have never seen them in action. Our pilots are warned to be very careful about such devices when used by the enemy. They can be deadly, even to our advanced air spacecraft. But,
yeah, we know, Irene forced a smile.
Your training is for fleet service.
Ma'am, she turned her attention back to Perkins.
Tutula is right. This is doable. Air defenses are not the biggest problem.
That remark drew a raised eyebrow from Perkins, so Irene continued.
Hitting this base is a waste, unless we recover data and hopefully samples from the research.
From what we, she pointed to Ernst Dahl, have been able to get from hacking in, all that data is housed here in the research complex in the center of the base. We can avoid damage to those buildings, but the defenders could trigger a program to erase all the data, or it might be set to erase automatically in the event that base is attacked.
But you have a plan for that?
Arlan Dahl has a plan, ma'am. The Giraptha raised himself up on his back legs before remembering other species were threatened by that posture, so he settled back down on all four legs.
The data connection between the research complex and the security center where the guards live is an underground cable here. For redundancy, they should have multiple cables. I think the connection is limited to a single cable because they are more concerned about their own people stealing data than about external threats. The cable is not deep. It is part of the original construction, and the plans state it is only...
The translator stumbled awkwardly, as it always did when converting measurements.
3.865 meters deep.
Dahl paused to see if Perkins understood, and she nodded.
Ma'am, Irene picked up the narrative. We have missiles that can blow a hole deeper than that. A missile can cut the cable so the defenders can't order the research corps to erase its data. Other missiles will drop off drones that can orbit the area and jam any backup wireless connection to the research base.
Which leaves only the problem of the research corps detecting an attack and erasing itself, Perkins shook her head.
I am not liking this plan. We have a plan for that also.
Dahl bobbed on his forelegs excitedly.
The research corps gets data from the base sensor network, also from that single cable. The corps may be programmed to erase itself in the event of an interruption in the sensor feed, and you can't take that risk.
Perkins noted the Giraptha had said you rather than we. While we have been unable to access the research core or the secure network, that cable also carries unsecure data, and there are buffers spaced regularly along the cable. We can hack into those buffers and plant false sensor data, so the research core will not know about our attack until the buffers overflow.
How long does that give us?
2 minutes and 48 seconds, Dahl flashed a Giraptha smile which made Perkins shudder, as it looked like a spider eating something.
Less than 3 minutes? That's not much time. Not enough to land a ship and get inside the research base to download the core.
No, Irene agreed. In those 168 seconds we need to cut the cable, then locate the cut end of the cable that leads to the research complex, and physically tap into it with a transmitter of our own that will keep feeding false sensor data.
She held up a small device that had a hole in it for plugging in a data cable.
That's a mighty tall order, Strebitch. Any way we can get a missile to drop off a drone that can attach to that cable?
We aren't carrying any drones like that, ma'am. And I wouldn't want to trust a drone to dig in a blast crater to find a severed cable. One of us needs to do it.
In 168 seconds, our missiles need to crest the ridge, sever that cable, then a dropship needs to fly there, slow down to land, and a team needs to dig down in a blast crater to find a cable.
Yes. We need to knock out air defenses first.
Irene gritted her teeth.
I assume you have a plan to do all this?
Yes, Colonel.
You want to see our assault plan?
Hell yes. Run through it for me.
Chapter 17. Tutula's fingers softly and expertly slid over the flight controls, making tiny adjustments to the aircraft's relatively leisurely progress over the surface. The Ruhar controls had been designed to be used by 4 fingers and a thumb, making it somewhat awkward for the 3-fingered Kristang, and the controls could only be modified to a limited extent. In that regard, the slow and primitive humans had an advantage over their Kristang comrades in arms, and Tutula was consoled by reminding herself she was more advanced in almost every other way. Her genetically modified strength, speed, coordination, and reactions made her physically far superior to any human, and awkward flight controls would be no obstacle to achieving her assigned mission.
Hawk 2 in position and ready,
she announced as her dropship raced over an imaginary line on the hills below. She was flying the only fighter dropship they had brought down from the route to Stella, a craft the humans called a vulture.
Stand by 2, the voice of Lieutenant Colonel Perkins ordered, and Tutula did not react other than her pupils widening slightly, a sign of pleasure among her species. When Tutula's people had first heard of the low-tech species who called themselves humans, she feared their culture would be cruel and oppressive to their females, either by nature or as distorted by the warrior caste of the Kristang. She had been extremely pleased to learn that human civilian and military organizations included females in positions of authority, even at the highest level. Perkins and General Bezensen were the 2 highest-ranking humans that Tutula knew of. The fact they were both female was encouraging.
Hawk 2, you are go to proceed.
Acknowledged, Hawk Lead, Tutula responded, and this time there was no mistaking her emotions. Her lips pulled back in a toothy grin as she contemplated the prospect of striking a direct blow against the warrior caste.
Missiles on automatic, she reported,
seeing on a side display that the other dropship's missile launchers had also been released to the auto-fire system. She advanced her throttle slightly to avoid losing airspeed as she pulled the nose up to crest the ridge of foothills and began climbing the tall mountains that ringed the valley where the research base sprawled across the dusty ground. When the navigation system determined she had reached a preset distance from the target, the Vulture's missile bay doors snapped open, and the rotary launchers spat out their deadly payloads. All of them. First in flight were the anti-AA missiles the humans for some reason called Wild Weasels, to scramble sensors and destroy the base's air defense maser cannon. Right behind were general-purpose missiles with pre-selected targets. And finally, a volley of missiles that could be retasked in flight as needed. This last group could extend their wings and loiter above the base for up to 20 minutes, but the attackers all knew the fight would be over in the first 3 minutes, or not at all. With her ship's entire missile payload expended and running on ahead in parallel with the other dropship's warbirds, Tutula saw a blue light flash on her console, and she reacted immediately, using a thumb to press the throttles to maximum. With missiles already approaching the mountain ridge, there was no longer a need to keep her speed subsonic. Shockwaves from the low-level passage of the missile formation were causing dust to swirl on the slopes of the mountains. The sonic boom of her passage would not be noticed in the chaos. With the corner of one eye, she verified the enemy base defenses had not yet reacted. The previous day, the tiny drones planted by the attackers had begun intermittently jamming the base's sensor network, turning the silent jamming on for brief periods. They knew from listening to the base communications system that the personnel there were angry and frustrated at what they assumed was an old and glitchy sensor network, and after 14 hours those Kristang had thrown up their hands and stopped trying to diagnose the problem. At first they had put defenses on alert and sent teams out to scan for danger. But when nothing was found again and again, they decided to ignore the glitches and not waste time trying to fix an antiquated system on an uninhabited and useless planet. That was why the defenders did not react when the jamming started again, just before the dropships launched their missiles. Actually, one of the defenders did react, but that reaction was an unhelpful gesture of slamming a rifle butt into the display screen of the sensor system when it apparently began glitching again. That move made the other guard on duty laugh, and delayed their reactions a half second when more than two dozen missiles screamed over the ridge of mountains to the south, and no one could be under the delusion that the base's sensors merely had a glitch. Tutula's ship was moving so fast, she had to roll it upside down and fire the belly jets as she passed over the sharp crest of the mountain ridge. The belly jets pushed the Vulture down so momentum did not carry it far out over the valley. Hanging in the sky on a high ballistic arc would not have been good for her survival, especially as her ship was momentarily lit by the sun that was just rising over the mountain ridge to the east. She grunted from the strain as she was squashed down in her seat, waiting so long to cut the jets and flip upright that her ship came heart-stoppingly close to scraping on the mountainside. Ignoring the G-force-induced haze in her vision, she flipped up a switch to enable the ship's maser cannons and searched for targets, even as she watched missile warheads exploding on the floor of the valley below. The personnel at the base, having no idea they were about to be thrust into the role of active defenders on a worthless planet that was unoccupied, were so bored and sick and tired and disgusted and generally pissed off that early morning. They were not entirely sure about the purpose of their mission, because the asshole scientists who were so important and smart as they huddled in their research compound had not bothered to inform the guards about the experiments they were conducting. But the guards were sure the mission was over, because the scientists and their staff and most of the primitive humans had already left the planet, yet the guards were still stuck there. Every single one of the guards had prayed for a serious accident to befall the dropship that had carried the scientists off the dusty surface, but their prayers had not been answered. Why hadn't the guards and the last group of humans been lifted away from the nasty prison of a planet that was about to be abandoned? Insurance. That was the only reason they had been given. Their remaining on the planet was a form of insurance, just in case something went wrong with the mission and more experiments needed to be conducted. When the mission, whatever it was, had been successfully completed, then and only then would a ship come to pull the guards and the last surviving humans off the surface. More than a few guards had speculated there would not be a ship coming at all, except maybe for the purpose of pounding the base into a smoking crater from orbit. A handful of guards were not worth the expense of sending a ship such a long distance across the star lanes, not with Kristang society engulfed in yet another civil war, and not when that star system was going to be abandoned as it was now too far from effective military support. Fretting that they had been discarded, angry at their impotence to control their fate, not having any clan leadership supervision, and just by nature being hateful assholes, the guards had taken to culling the remaining humans one by one or in pairs, to use for sport. At first they had dropped off humans on the other side of the mountain ridge where the stupid humans in their own compound at the base could not see what was happening. The first hunt had been frustrating. The Kristang simply dumped the former soldier on the ground and told him to run as they readied their hunting gear. That human evaded pursuit by unexpectedly going uphill and hiding in a shallow cavern. It was not until the next morning that the guards, having grown tired and frustrated and bored with the game, activated the tracking device they had injected into their quarry. At that point, angry they had been duped and had wasted most of a day looking in entirely the wrong place, They hammered the cavern with a missile, burying the human where he died. Subsequent hunts were scarcely more satisfying, as the star-blasted planet had no trees and their human prey had difficulty finding cover. Even arming the prey with primitive projectile pistols did not offer much sport, because being armed gave the prey a foolish sense of confidence and drew them out, where they were easily killed by the armor-suited hunters. After slaughtering 4 humans in hunts that were not much fun at all, the guards tried another game that offered much more sport. Unarmed combat. Taking off their armored suits, a guard went into a makeshift sparring ring with a human, and later, a pair of humans. Giving the humans short knives was necessary to make the combat interesting, though even then, the Kristang usually quickly took away the knives and turned them on the prey. The games were just getting fun, with 2 guards sustaining serious knife wounds, when their leader declared a stop to the games. They were running low on humans, so if the scientists ever did return and needed the humans for experiments, they would be extremely upset to find all the test subjects had been killed for sport. After the games were over, most of the guards had taken to sleeping late, since they had almost nothing to do other than making sure the remaining humans did not escape from their prison compound. Escape where? None of the native life was edible to humans, so other than a guard doing a remote headcount twice a day, they ignored the humans and spent their time struggling against boredom. The only mildly interesting thing that had happened for weeks was an intermittent sensor glitch that no one cared enough about to diagnose. So, when a cloud of missiles streaked over the mountain ridge, followed by a pair of Ruhar dropships, the guards were caught completely by surprise. Most of them were asleep, with only 2 technically on duty and the base's security center. Those 2 froze for crucial seconds, disbelieving the attack could be real. Surely it had to be a surprise exercise thrown at them by the base commander, who had grown disgusted by his men's lack of discipline and the slovenly state of their quarters. The missiles had to be part of a simulation. And the guard who had smashed the glitchy sensor display was tempted to let the sim play out without reacting so the base commander would not get the satisfaction of seeing his men racing around for nothing. Then the ground shook as an incoming missile was exploded by the 1 functioning Mazer air defense cannon, and the 2 guards scrambled into action, triggering an alarm and powering up the defense shield that protected the control center. Raising that shield when the attack began might have been a good idea, but raising it as missiles were already impacting actually shortened the guards' lives. The first volley of missiles were weighted heavily toward taking out anti-aircraft defenses, concentrating on destroying the single active Mazer cannon turret. The missiles Irene had named Wild Weasels quickly overwhelmed the Mazer cannon, saturating its sensor network with submunitions that scrambled the sensor data or directly attacked the targeting sensors with their own single-use Mazer blasts. Within its armored turret, the computer controlling the Mazer cannon was calmly concentrating on prioritizing targets and trying to see through the confused sensor data when the thick armor of the turret cracked under direct impact of 2 shaped charge warheads. The superheated plasma of the warheads burned through the armor and fried the power feeds to the Mazer, rendering it useless and shattering the Mazer's exciters before it had a chance to even detect the pair of vulnerable dropships coming over the mountain crest behind the missiles. The second volley of missiles went straight for pre-programmed targets, flying violently erratic courses until the base's air defense was knocked offline, then giving up any evasive maneuvering and boring through the air straight at their designated targets. The enemy dropship was exploded to prevent that unflyable hulk being used as a stationary missile or Mazer cannon platform. Missiles plunged into the base housing, killing all the guards who were still asleep or racing out of warm beds to react to the threat. With all primary targets destroyed, most of the last wave of missiles queried the battle control systems aboard the lead dropship and were told to switch to secondary targets, then targets of opportunity. One missile, having already deployed its wings and opened air-breathing doors to extend the time it could loiter over the base, saw an opportunity. The base control center, considered both a hard target and unnecessary now that base air defense was down, had foolishly delayed raising the separate energy shield that protected it. "Well, ain't this some shit," the missile said to a missile orbiting in the air beside it. "Sloppy," the second missile's tiny yet intelligent brain responded over the tactical network. "They are way too slow." "I hate sloppy soldiers," the first missile declared.
I bet their bunks are unmade and their footlockers are unlocked. If there is one thing in this world that I hate, it is an unlocked footlocker. Damn, that defense shield is still only 12% charged, the second missile noted with surprise and disgust. Hey, I have an idea. The pair of missiles linked their targeting data, shed their wings, and closed their air-breathing ducts. Gouts of white-hot flame scorched the air behind them as they plunged downward, zipping through the strengthening energy shield as if it weren't there at all, and detonating their warheads on wide dispersal pattern. The brains of the two guards did not even have time to think, "Damn, this sucks," before they became dark stains on a wall just prior to that wall being churned into vapor. Ironically, the original assault plan had called for leaving the control center untouched in the initial phase because the attack planners had assumed the powerful energy shield would be active. The slow reaction of the guards prevented them from living long enough to see who had hit them. Sergeant Jaetz tensed, poised at the back ramp of the second dropship. The ramp was already opening as the craft first dropped sickeningly at a high-speed descent, then stood on its nose with forward thrusters firing to slow its progress as the ground rushed up to meet it. He felt the floor tilt, and he was grateful for the strong restraints that held him securely as his powered skin-suit legs absorbed the strain of the ship flaring to land. Jaetz knew his genetically enhanced body could take G-forces that would render a human unconscious. His concern was that he could not complete the task alone, and the Girapta was needed for breaking into the research core. That left humans as his only assistants, and he was not confident as he glanced at the biosigns in a corner of his visor. All three of his team members were showing high heart rates, dangerous blood pressure, and were fluttering on the verge of unconsciousness. He noted two of them were slumping against their restraints, temporarily useless. The three sergeants did not appear to be very capable of performing the mission, but Jaetz reminded himself the warrior caste had been hurt very badly, twice, when they underestimated humans. Then he had no more time for worry, because the ramp was fully open and the ground was in sight. While the dropship was still 5 meters in the air, he popped free of the restraints and leaped out, diving headfirst through the opening, then flipping to fall feet first, trusting the skin suit and his enhanced bone structure and muscles to survive the fall. He hit hard and rolled in a well-practiced maneuver, the skin suit steadying him and helping flip him upright. As soon as his boots contacted the ground, he was running with power-boosted strides, keeping low as time in the air between strides was time his legs could not propel him forward. The crater made by the missile that had cut the data link to the research compound was in front of him by another 40 meters, according to the glowing numbers at the bottom right of his helmet visor. An idle part of his brain told him 40 meters in the common human measurements the team used was 35 latrans in Cristang terms, a bit of trivia that became useless as his boots skidded and brought him to a halt at the blackened lip of the crater. The shape-charged warhead had focused its explosive energy downward to slice the buried cable, so the lip of the crater was only 8 meters across. But smoke and dust obscured even the enhanced vision provided by his helmet, and the crumbly dry sand the base was built on was already sliding down to fill in the hole. He pulled a compression grenade off his belt, checking to verify it was still on its lowest power setting, pressed the button with the thumb, and dropped it in the hole. There was a blast of air, but no shrapnel, so he did not bother to duck out of the way or even flinch, knowing the Ruhar skin suit and helmet would protect him. The blast momentarily cleared the air in the hole, creating a vacuum that was quickly erased by inrushing air that swirled with even more dust and smoke. That did not matter, as Jaetz's helmet sensor had built an accurate picture of the hole during the split second his vision had been clear. "We have a problem," he announced over the tactical circuit. "What is it?" Jesse asked as he skidded to a stop behind Jaetz almost too quickly, needing the Verdcris to steady him from toppling into the hole. Jaetz said nothing about the human's clumsiness, merely flexing his ankles to hop down into the dust-obscured hole. "Oh, shit," Jesse exclaimed as his visor fed him the synthetic view Jaetz had acquired. The missile had impacted at a junction where, sometime after the base was built, someone had spliced in a cable at a right angle, running back to a building behind Jesse. The junction was not a problem. The problem was someone had the bright idea to protect the splice by encasing it in a block of some hard ceramic material. Pieces of the ceramic had flaked away, and there were pockmarks on the side where the warhead had exploded, but the hard block was not cracked.
What about? Can we blow it apart? Shauna asked behind him, already unslinging her backpack that contained a mix of explosive charges that had been selected for various yields.
We can try it, Dave suggested.
Darling, no, not this time, Jesse declared as he slid down into the hole on his backside, the skin suit automatically stiffening to protect him from cuts and scrapes. I only blew up one island, Jesse. This is not funny. I'm all for blowing shit up, but we don't have time, Jesse cut her off. Jates, this thing can't be that big. I can see the cable coming in from the side, and it looks to me it's not as thick as my arm is long. Can we just pull it away?
Jates had his gloves gripping the block on top and had been using his suit's power to nudge the block back and forth while the humans argued. His intent had been to judge the block's size by his ability to move it so they could scale explosives appropriately. He had not thought of simply moving the block out of the way. The human called Jesse, or Cornpone, had a point. They had precious little time before the data buffers overflowed.
Sergeant Coulter, we can try. I will take this side.
Jesse grunted and strained to dig his gloved fingertips into the hard ceramic until he could see it was no use. He had to rely on the gecko-like grip of the gloves. Even they slipped, and he fell backwards just as the block began to move.
I can't get a grip. It's too smooth, he spat in frustration.
Jates agreed without words, flexing his gloves that also had failed to gain a purchase.
28 seconds, guys, Dave warned, and just then, inspiration struck him. Jates, Jesse, duck down, he warned as he fell onto the block, feeling it rock beneath him.
Pulling his rifle out of the sling, he selected explosive-tipped flechettes and shouted, Fire in the hole!
Ow, shit!
The explosive rounds barely had time to arm themselves after they left the gun barrel, as Dave had the muzzle almost too close to the block. Sharp chips of ceramic pelted his legs, faceplate, and worst of all, the crotch of his skin suit. He was saved only because the rifle had communicated with the suit, so the suit's computer stiffened the skin before the first round left the barrel.
Ugh, ah, God damn it!
Come on, Ski, quit whining, Jesse grunted as he grabbed his friend's legs and pulled him down to tumble awkwardly into the hole behind Jesse. He felt for a handhold blasted by the rifle and found several.
Got a grip now?
Yes, Jates acknowledged, and dug three fingers into cracks caused by the rifle rounds. 3, 2, 1, pull.
The heavy block did not move at all. Then it moved all at once as it lost its grip on the soil around it. Jesse and Jates fell backward on top of Dave, and the block toppled over onto all three of them.
Don't you guys move, Shauna ordered. I see the end of the cable exposed. I'm reaching down for it.
13 seconds, Dave reported unseen from the bottom of the pile.
I know,
Shauna snapped with irritation, tossing aside her pack to get access to the only thing she needed right then, a data transmitter the size and shape of a golf ball. The ball had a hole which Shauna carefully fitted the cable end into, except the damned frayed cable caught on the lip of the hole and refused to go in.
Gotta cut a fresh end.
She pulled a knife off her belt and, holding the golf ball firmly but carefully, sliced through the cable to create a clean end. She dropped the knife and breathlessly threaded the cable into the hole of the golf ball. Instantly, her visor lit up to report a solid connection.
Got it. Colonel Perkins, we have a connection. Our fake sensor data is flowing through the cable.
I see it. Perkins's voice sounded shaky, which might have something to do with the timer showing the buffers would have overflowed in 8 seconds if Shauna had not hooked the computer into the cable. Or it could be not knowing whether the core in the research compound believed the bullshit sensor data fed into the cable. The data they fed in was simply recordings of real sensor input with the time codes adjusted, but the team had no way of knowing whether the core could tell it was being spoofed.
Good work.
Great,
Dave gasped from the bottom of the pile.
Did you guys get off of me? You're heavy.
Extracting themselves from the hole was not easy, as they could not simply push the ceramic block away without risk it might fall on the data transmitter. Shauna stayed holding the transmitter, wrapping a high-tech type of duct tape to hold it in place, while Jates and Jesse wriggled out from under the block, holding it up so Dave could crawl out.
Thanks, guys.
Dave stood up in the hole, brushing smeared dirt off his skin suit.
You okay, Ski?
Jesse inspected his friend's suit, not seeing any tears.
Yeah,
I'm fine. The suit went rigid to protect me. Problem was, my legs were bent at a bad angle down in the hole when the suit locked up and I couldn't move.
Damn.
He glanced down at his thighs and crotch where ceramic chips had scratched the tough suit material.
I almost shot my balls off. Not doing that again.
He reached up to pull himself out of the hole, his head clearing the lip of the crater, and to use the chin of his helmet to dig into the crumbling soil.
Now we... Whoa!
He slid back into the hole as gunfire erupted, rounds biting into the crater lip where his head had been moments before.
We got company!
I see them.
Derek held his voice steady as he swiveled the Dodo dropship's belly maser cannon turret and sent withering fire toward a pair of Krestang who were shooting at the away team, stitching a line across the ground and slicing into one of the armor-suited figures.
Damn it, Derek shouted, and the maser cut off. Bring us around. That damn building got into my line of sight.
What's inside that building? Perkins asked from her console behind the pilots while her stomach flip-flopped from the tight turn Irene pulled the dropship into.
Nothing important, Derek replied distractedly, concentrating on holding the targeting sensor on the gap between buildings where the enemy had been.
Then light it up, Perkins ordered. Away team, keep your heads down.
Yes, ma'am, Derek cursed himself for not thinking of that.
On the way!
With the maser exciters cranked up to full power, the beam blasted the building apart, smoke, fire, and debris erupting skyward.
I can't see anything. Away team, you see any hostiles?
We can't see shit,
Jesse reported as a camera popped up above his helmet on a thin stalk, showing him only a chaotic cloud of dust and scorch-marked debris raining down. No way was he sticking his head above the crater lip until he was certain the two Krestang were dead.
Ow!
He ducked down as a chunk of debris clanked off his helmet.
We're getting pelted with building parts down here.
The transmitter is safe, Shauna assured the team as she huddled over the device, protecting it with her body.
Should I hold fire? Derek asked.
Hell no,
Jesse snorted. Seriously? He asked himself. The infantry have their asses hanging out to dry on the ground and the close air support is asking whether to expend ordnance?
Hit it again! Maser beams don't cost us nothing!
Derek poured maser fire to saturate the area in case there were more Krestang hidden in the cluster of buildings, until there was no cluster of buildings, only shattered and smoking ruins, pieces of walls standing by themselves, and debris cascading down all over the area. Derek winced as he saw pieces of buildings spinning through the air in the direction of the research compound, and he was relieved to see puffs of dust kicked up on the ground as the chunks fell well short.
I've got nothing left to target, ma'am.
He glanced back to Perkins, just as his console flashed red with a new threat.
Shit! Irene, get us out of here now!
The pair of Krestang who fired on the away team had intended to kill the attackers who were assumed to be Ruhar based on their familiar flexible skin suits, the rifles they carried, and most importantly, the unmistakable outlines of their dropships. The two guards had hurriedly pulled on their old third-hand powered armor suits, ignored the multiple warning lights of systems that had failed or were on the verge of failure, and emerged inside the building closest to the away team by using a tunnel that was not part of the original base construction. They did not know why the attacking aliens had bothered to drop down into a crater, in a part of the base that was not at all of any importance and was not near any of the tunnels. All they knew was they had been ordered to kill the aliens with maximum violence, and that is what they did. Except the maximum violence part was inflicted upon them by a dropship flying close air support. They died not knowing whether they had hit any of the aliens, and they died not knowing their part of the base defense was a decoy, a mere distraction. A quarter kilometer away from the away team, in an area of the base that appeared to be nothing but storage sheds, dirt and dust arced upward as two large buried doors swung open, revealing a ramp, and in a flash, a large vehicle was racing up the ramp to slew sideways to a halt. If the Krestang had ever seen a Mad Max movie, they might have taken their inspiration to build that vehicle. It was based on a large truck that had been retired from service because two of its four motors were burned out and the frame was cracked. In its new role, the truck did not need to drive far, nor did it need to maneuver over uneven terrain. It only needed to climb the ramp into the open. Once the truck reached the surface and drove onto a hard ceramic pad that had been set down to hold its weight, it stopped, and explosive pistons fired downward to bore into the pad, holding the truck in place securely and permanently. The truck was a one-use